time to thrive. Welcome to the Thriveology Podcast with Dr. Lee Bockham. Join us as we explore ways that you can thrive in your life, regardless of what life throws at you. It's your life. Time to live it.
A number of years back, now that my son is headed off to college and a young adult, I think back to the days when he was a Cub Scout. I was one of the leaders of his group, and I remember this one particular conversation. The boys were all occupied at the tables. You know, we were at the elementary school, and we had had some playtime, and they had been tussling with each other, but now it was craft time. And so they were all sitting around doing their little craft. I don't even remember what the craft is, but I remember the conversation, because you know what happens when boys that age are caught up in some activity? They start talking, and they have very interesting conversations. And these boys were talking about somebody who was being courageous. They used the word courage, and I picked up on that. And I went over and I said, "Hey guys, what do you think courage is?" And then the interesting conversation started. And they told me that people who were courageous had no fear, that they would face things that were so frightening to everybody else because they had no fear. So their courage was this lack of fear. And I said, you know, I don't really think I believe that. I believe that courage is something else. I believe that courage is when we act in spite of the fear, when we act staring fear right in the face, where we almost disregard fear. The fear is there. It has to be there. And I pointed out to them that if there was no fear there, it really wasn't any courage to it. It was just doing something. If I had no fear about taking some action, it's just an action. It's just doing something because I have no fear. But when we decide to act courageously, we're doing it not without fear, but kind of in spite of fear, just facing up to the fear and moving forward. What I've come to believe is that thrivers know how to be courageous, not how to be fearless, but how to be courageous. This is Lee Bockham, and as we continue our series on what thriving people do differently, today we take a look at being courageous. For me, this is one of the big pieces. Last week we talked about convictions, and convictions is when you act on your moral compass. You act on what you know is right, whether you're by yourself or whether everybody's looking at you and putting pressure on you. You decide to move forward in a place that is representative of your convictions. This week is a little bit different. Now, there can be some fears back there on why we would move towards our convictions, but acting courageously is what we do when we have fear. And I believe that we have been given kind of a lie about fear. Fear pretends to be a friend of ours. Fear pretends to kind of sit on your shoulder and keep you safe. And my feeling is that all that fear is really doing is keeping you down, keeping you small. It pretends to be your fear, but the problem is whenever we give attention to that fear, whenever we treat that fear like a friend, the fear grows, and it grows larger and larger and takes over bigger and bigger parts of our lives and points to more and more things that might be of danger to us, that might need to be avoided. And over time, we find ourselves completely limited in our lives. Anais Nin said that life shrinks or expands in proportion to one's courage. Not to one's fears, but how one takes action in spite of the fears. So Anais is not talking about how we act when there is no fear, but how we act when we are feeling fearful. Cherie Huber said, every time we choose safety, we reinforce fear. That's when we allow that voice on our side to tell us something that we know is not true, but we fear it's true. We feel that within us. Now, let me first say that I do believe that there is an evolutionary link to this fear. That the reason that you are here and I am here is because our ancestors were just a little more fearful and just a little more careful than some other people, other creatures, that's DNA ended on the field as lunch or dinner someday. And so while there might have been a group that looked at that saber-toothed tiger or listened to that little rustle behind the bushes and thought, you know, I'm just going to stand here and see what happens, there was a whole nother group of people who got out of the way, a whole nother group of creatures that fled the scene and passed the DNA down. And the DNA that was passed down was more and more cautious. And that's what got through the dangerous times. Now, we don't live in such dangerous times. In fact, if you're listening to this podcast, the good chance is that you're safe most of the time, that you might have a few moments where you take a risk and walk down a dark street or something else, but day by day, you live pretty safely. That's just the nature, and yet we're still stuck with this DNA that keeps us playing it safe, trying to stay away from imagined dangers. In fact, most of the time, that's exactly what's going on. We're imagining the threats that are coming our way. So we have an evolutionary piece. We have this place where our body believes that we are at risk. And so whenever we hear a certain tone in someone's voice or we see something happen, we have an immediate response of fear, even though there's no real threat. Sometimes we do watch people on the news who act courageously when there really is a threat. But most of the time we're talking about the fears that keep us stuck because our evolutionary process keeps us at that place of always listening to the fear, knowing that at one point that fear really did keep us alive. Now all it does is it keeps us playing it safe and really keeps us playing it small. We can't move forward with grabbing great pieces of life, of thriving in life, if we're always listening to the fear. Now, that doesn't mean you have to disregard your safety, but listening to the fear as a voice that's telling you what not to do is dangerous. You see, we've come to believe that fear is an avoidance indicator. It's telling us something that's not to be approached, that's something that should be kept at bay, something that should be avoided. And I would prefer you to think of fear as an importance indicator. It's not an avoidance indicator. It's pointing out that something's important. And sometimes it's important because there is a risk. If I'm running down the trail and I see a little squiggly thing on the trail, the fact that I come to an instant stop to check it out keeps me safe. But it's only pointing out that that's an important thing. At that point, I then have to step back and say, how much do I need to avoid it? The problem is many of us use fear as an avoidance indicator. If we feel the fear, we back away from whatever's causing that fear. But it's so often just pointing out the importance of something. Let's say that you're going on a job interview, and it's a job you don't care about. You probably don't have a lot of anxiety, a whole lot of fear, and you walk in with no true built-up anxiety because you don't care about that job. So in this case, it's showing us the fear of not being there. It's just not important to you. But think about that dream job, that job you've been thinking about and praying for and hoping for and wishing for, and suddenly it opens up. And there it is, and you've been asked to the job interview, and you feel the overwhelming level of fear. Well, that fear is indicating not that you should avoid that interview, but how important it is. Or think of it maybe an earlier time in life when maybe you were trying to find someone that could be a life partner for you, and you're standing and you're looking across the room and you see someone, and that someone might be a friend, not someone who really interests you, and so it's easy to go and strike up a conversation. But you see somebody that is that person, that perfect image for you. The person who you think might be it, and suddenly you're overwhelmed with anxiety and you feel those knots in your stomach. The butterflies are just huge. They're condors in your stomach. And all that fear is telling you not that you shouldn't go over and talk to that person, but how important it is to go talk to that person. The importance level has been jumped up. And that's what you need to think about with fear. Fear is an importance indicator. Sometimes it's indicating that it's important to avoid this. It's important to stay safe. The problem is we use that as the regular way of using fear. Fear becomes the way to avoid things, the indicator that you need to stay away from it. And then you start playing it small. Now, that's the immediate fear piece. We all have those places where we're just suddenly cast into immediate fear. And you can think of those things that are around safety and just our natural reaction to being startled. I have a son who loves and has his whole life enjoyed jumping out and scaring us. And so that's a sudden fear response, kind of a startle response. But around issues of safety and reaction and risks, we have an immediate fear response that we need to be watching. Years ago, when we were on a vacation, we were out at the Grand Canyon, and I had kids who were fairly young at that point, and one boy who was daring at that point, fairly young, and would run towards the edge of things, and then a daughter who wasn't quite so sure-footed, and she would stumble around. And I remember the whole time we were looking at the Grand Canyon, I was cast in fear that something would happen to them. My fear indicators were telling me that I needed to keep an eye on them. And so as I'm looking out over the Grand Canyon, I have one child by the back of his t-shirt and the other child by the back of her overalls. And we were just waiting to get away from the edge to feel safe again. Now, that's one type of fear. But then there is another level of fear that is telling you that this really is something important to pay attention to, not to avoid, but to pay attention to. I've talked with people who are under the impression that people who do kind of frightening things in life, you know, the base jumpers or extreme sport people, that they just don't have fear. And what I've discovered, having had discussions with many, is that they do have the fear. They just interpret it differently. They have the same feelings I have. They have the same anxieties and the same funny feelings in their feet and the same feeling in the pit of their stomach before they do something that anyone would have. But they interpret that as excitement, and they use that fear as a way of keeping them focused, of making sure that they're doing everything they can to successfully complete that. And so when they're base jumping, they're carefully folding up their parachutes because they know their life depends on it. It's not that they have no fear of that. It's that they feel it and register that as excitement, and then they use that as a way of making sure that they attend to what has to happen. And so in that case, they're using their fear as an important indicator. This is something that I'm taking as a calculated risk, and I'm seeing it as something important enough that I have to be careful. So while we may look at those kinds of events and say, wow, that person must have no fear in order to do that, it's that fear response that they're actually moving towards and using. Now, there's another level of fear, and this is what I refer to as the existential fears. And I think that they really are around three different areas. These are the fears that keep you up at night. And these existential fears come in three different categories. One is that you won't have enough. Two is that you won't be loved enough. And three is that you're not good enough. These are pieces of fear that we all have within us. The not having enough is one of the most basic fears. It's the fear that afflicts almost everyone, regardless of how much someone has. In fact, many people who suffer the greatest pull of this fear have plenty. And this fear is very creative. We often believe it's only about money, but it's not. It's about having enough of anything, enough friends, enough time, enough toys, enough health, you name it. This fear drives us in a need to find more and more. For some, this is the root cause of the tendencies to hoard. We look at people in the news whose homes are stacked from floor to ceiling with junk, trash, magazines, whatever. But we fail to notice how our own ways of hoarding, of hiding money in accounts or under beds, of having friends that we never have contact with and don't really have anything in common with, gadgets that don't meet our needs and yet lure us to buy them anyway. We hoard rolls of tissue paper as if there will never be more, or at least more on sale, and we move to bigger and bigger homes to hold more and more of our stuff. We're predisposed to want to hold on to things. In fact, just look at the design of our bodies. The vast majority find it very easy to gain weight, to have our fat cells accumulate the extra calories. But we find our bodies are very resistant to letting the weight go. Even at a cellular level, we end up hoarding. Our bodies have lived through times of feast and times of famine, and those able to efficiently hold on to those extra calories got to pass on their genes, and their bodies quickly burned through the available supplies while they perished. But it is a fear of not having enough that leaves us scrambling through daily life so close to our work that we miss the destruction of this drive. Few people arrive at the end of their lives with regret for the time they took in leisure, but many are lost in the fact that they allowed work to be propelled by fear. Many would argue that perhaps it is this very fear that has led us to many great successes, and in many ways, that's correct. But it's another bit of irony that humans are much better at running away from something than running towards something. In other words, we're often more motivated by fear than by the goal. It's also unfortunate, then, that as this fear extracts a heavy toll on the individual, in some sense it is as a society that profits from this motivation of fear at the expense of the individual. Look at it in a corporate sense. The bottom line of a corporation is often directly related to the degree of effort exerted by individuals in that corporation. If fear is nipping at the heels of these individuals, more effort is exerted. This effort pays off for the company, but rarely for the individual. The reward for extra effort and extra time spent at work? Often it's more responsibility, more stress, and more time required. The individual is not benefiting in the same way the corporation does. In fact, the cost can be rather heavy. Our bodies are designed to live with stress for short periods of time, not for entire careers. And in the short term, stress creates a readiness in the body for that fight or flight response. But in the long term, our bodies begin to break down when exposed to a constant level of stress. High blood pressure, diabetes, even cancer, all have been attributed as outcomes to stress. As is often the case, sometimes a fear has a basis in reality. Perhaps there really is a shortage, but there really isn't enough. But sometimes a fear is just irrational. It is not a reflection of reality. We come to believe that there is not enough, but that exists only within the paradigm we weave within our mind, with the thoughts that we tell ourselves that keep us thinking there's not going to be enough. That's one fear. Another fear of not being good enough. This fear is one of comparison and of competition. We tend to judge ourselves against another standard. This standard is often comparison between what we know about ourselves and what we believe about the other person. In other words, we end up comparing all the negative stuff we think is true about ourselves to the positive image others portray to us and we portray to them. We end up seeing the yuck of our own lives but fail to see it in the other. When this is the case, there's no way for us to measure up. I know my internal world, but not that of the person I use for comparison, so all my faults end up being placed against the strengths of the other person. A fear of not being good enough, in evolutionary terms, is the reality of the survival of the fittest. If I'm not good enough, I will not get the resources I need or mate I need to continue my and my gene survival. But here's the problem. All living organisms are in this struggle. Day to day, moment to moment, only humans seem capable, though, of making themselves miserable over this. It's merely a long-term question for other organisms. We humans, on the other hand, constantly underestimate our individual selves while really overestimating ourselves as a species. That fear keeps us moving, though, of not being good enough, keeps us feeling bad about ourselves and always driving for something else, something beyond where we are. And then there's the not being loved enough. You see, we humans really are pack animals. We need connection. We seek community. Studies show that when people do not experience enough affection and love as infants and children, their long-term development is negatively impacted. In other words, when we don't get enough love, we suffer. That need never goes away. In fact, one of the highest-ranking determinants of life satisfaction is having loving relationships. That may not be a spouse or a partner, but we all have the need to feel a sense of belonging. Friends and family may fulfill that role, or it may be a spouse or partner. Notice how we build communities with clubs, churches, social organizations, informal gatherings, even lunch groups at work. So this fear of not being loved enough strikes deeply within us. It is a fear that this basic need to be a part of a group, to feel accepted and loved, will not happen. This is the fear that has us worried about our relationships, our love life, what people think of us, and influences how we interact with people. The stronger this fear, the harder we work to not be rejected. Sometimes this ends up being a very needy approach to relationships. Sometimes this ends up being an act of not needing anyone. If you know people who reject others before they are rejected, that person is as much caught up in this fear as someone who will do anything to maintain a relationship. So these are our three existential fears: that we won't have enough, that we won't be good enough, that we won't be loved enough. And those three fears are the ones that we wake up around and we don't know what to do. So let's talk some about what we do about these fears. The first thing when we deal with fear is to use fear as that importance indicator. It's not that fear is useless. Fear is a very important indicator for us. It tells us that we're moving towards something that's quite important to us. The question is what we do about that indicator. So the first thing is to use fear as an importance indicator. Sometimes it's going to be important to pay attention to something to avoid it, to stay safe. When I'm trail running, that squiggly line, I need to stay safe. I need to be thinking about how close I am to the edge. There's some reality to the dangers in the world around us. But sometimes it's important as an indicator that it's pointing to something that we just need to pay attention to, that we might be moving towards something that's crucial. Sometimes it's a job. Sometimes it's another relationship. Sometimes it's a project, something that catches us and holds on to us. So use it as an importance indicator, not an avoidance indicator. Number two, distinguish between the, kind of the immediate fears and those existential fears. To understand them by looking at them and saying, is this one of those immediate, I'm just caught by it kind of places of fear? Or does it fall into one of those bigger existential fears of life? Now, those big existential fears are just the same thing. They're based in our thoughts, but they may indicate something important to how we want to move forward. Number three, belly breathe through your fear. We've talked about belly breathing some other times, but it's important to recognize that belly breathing is a physiological response in our body to the fear. You see, when we are in that fear place, our bodies go to a fight or flight response. It's a very primitive response, and it only listens to very primitive ways of telling our bodies that everything's okay. When we start breathing through our chest, which is what we do when we're caught up in that fight or flight response, we flood our system with adrenaline. We're telling our body that it's got to be ready to fight, and so we tense up our stomach to protect all those vital organs, and we are breathing only through our ineffective chest. So belly breathing, when we go back to a natural state of breathing, when we breathe through our diaphragm into our belly, that's telling our brain that everything's okay. It does a short circuit. It's kind of, think of it as an accelerator. If you want to punch on the accelerator of your body, breathe through your chest. If you want to put the brakes on that system, breathe through your belly. The easiest way to figure out how to do that belly breathing is to lie down on the floor. Put a hand over your chest and a hand over your belly button. Make sure that you find how you can breathe so only the hand that's over your belly button moves. At that point, you're doing the belly breathing. Use that as a repetitive process when you feel that fear build up to calm your body down so that you can begin to think through what's going on and what's important about this. Which brings us to the next piece. Notice, number four, that fear is rooted in a thought. That thought can be tied into some core beliefs of yours, whether it's a fearful belief or an aspirational belief, but it's about a thought. You're thinking something when you're feeling that fear. So to be able to step back and say, what am I thinking about that's making me so fearful? Sometimes that helps us get to the place where we can then really be plugged into the importance indicator of that thought. Sometimes it's important enough to say, you know what, that's just a thought, I've got to let it go. Then the next step, number five. This is a huge one, action. Action is always an antidote to fear. When you feel that fear, to say, what is the next thing I need to do, is an important way of breaking the spell that fear casts upon us. Action is always the most helpful antidote to a fearful place. When I'm running along the trail and I see that squiggly spot, my action may be to come to a sudden stop or to jump over or move around, but there's an action associated. When I find something important that I need to move towards, the first step is the one I need to find, how to begin to take the next step towards that. Action is the antidote to fear. And number seven is move toward your purpose. Move toward your convictions. Whenever you're stuck in a place of paralysis by fear, think about your purpose in life. What is that place you want to move towards? What are the convictions you want to live out? And allow that to help you navigate your automatic fearful response. Now, if we put these two pieces together of living with your convictions and living with courage, you'll notice that it pretty much covers all of the actions in everyday life. If we live within our convictions, if we're acting out from our convictions, we're using our moral compass to make our decisions. Courage comes when fear catches us and we still have to move forward. Sometimes they come very close, very much hand in hand. But courage is not the lack of fear. Courage is choosing to act and allow the fear to point out what's important, and then to begin to make the next step forward. Don't allow fear to paralyze you. Allow it to be an importance indicator. Fear is not your friend. It's just letting you know that something's important and you need to choose how to move forward with it. This is Lee Balcom wishing you a thriving life.
You've been listening to the Thriveology Podcast. Thank you for listening. If you want more information, visit us at Thriveology.com or at ThriveologyMagazine.com. Remember that Thriveology is spelled T-H-R-I-V-E-O-L-O-G-Y. It's your life. Time to live it.